Welcome once again, everybody, to the New York Jazz Workshop podcast. I'm your host, CJ Shern. On this podcast, I've featured interviews with some of the biggest names in jazz, including Antonio Sanchez, saxophone legend David Liebman, and guitarist David Fusinski and Dave Stryker. I've also made it a point on this podcast to feature interviews with up-and-coming talent, such as alto saxophonist Logan Richardson, vocalist Tana Alexa, and pianist Takeshi Osai. I continue the tradition on this podcast featuring guitarist Brian Caston. The Glen Cove native is an eccentric and original guitarist blending jazz, jazz rock, and free jazz into an incredibly appealing whole. His latest album is entitled Not So Standard and features a group with Grammy winner Miles Griffith on vocals, bassist Steve Rust, and Peter O'Brien on drums. Last year, Caston released the stunning two-disc album Roll the Dice on Life, which among open-minded jazz blogs and institutions was considered one of the best jazz albums of 2016. I spoke with Mr. Caston about the album, the band members, and the choice to turn well-known standards literally inside out. Remember that the New York Jazz Workshop podcast is just part of what the New York Jazz Workshop does to increase the scope of jazz education, not only in the New York City area, but also the world. Featuring a variety of classes and disciplines, such as improvisation, vocals, and big band, taught by a world-class faculty, there is always something happening at the New York Jazz Workshop. Also, vocalist Faye Victor, part of the New York Jazz Workshop faculty, appears on the new album by trombonist Roswell Rudd called Embrace, featuring pianist Lafayette Harris Jr. and bassist Ken Filiano. The album will be released on the Rare Noise label in November on CD, 2LP, and digital download formats. Here is my interview with Brian Caston. You have your 10th album as a leader out now, which is Not So Standard. And like we talked about the other night, it really is a quite refreshing take on that particular genre with, you know, jazz standards, because there's certainly been albums in the past, you know, 15, 20 years that have done that as well, like Gary Thomas's Till We Have Faces, but this one is just unbelievably unique, and it's the same quartet that you have on Roll the Dice on Life, which is destined to be a cult classic. So just talk about the process of this album and this band, because you did meet Miles Griffith while teaching, right?
Correct. Yeah, I was a high school teacher at the time, and I was teaching 50 kids at a time guitar and also running a percussion ensemble. He was just coming in for a class here and there to work with a vocal ensemble, and I heard him talking and saying something really interesting. I just peeked my head in and said, "Hey, how you doing?" And that was it. We just started to talk about music, and we got together and played, and we clicked. So this band consists of Miles Griffith on vocals, Steve Rust on bass, and Peter O'Brien on drums. So Roll the Dice on Life was all original fusion type of thing. I love the vibe of the band so much that I thought, hey, let's do another album called Not So Standard. And the reason why Not So Standard evolved into the way it did is because everyone in the band, as far as Miles and Steve and Pete, all three of them have a voice. And so when we work together, we're able to implement how we improvise as a group into the standards. You know, it's funny because I knew we were going to do this interview today, and I was just thinking of things that you'd ask me. And what popped into my head was, you know, Not So Standard to me was just something that we naturally would do anyway. When we were on a gig, we would just naturally take these songs out or put a spin on it. You know, the way I see it as in the year 2017 is, you know, these songs are old. You know, some of them are 70, 80-year-old tunes. And why try and recreate what was already done? the people who wrote these beautiful creative tunes back then were cutting edge, were writing beautiful songs, and it was new. So in 2017, you know, just trying to say what we want to say now and create what we want now in this present time.
Oh, yeah, and definitely on this album, and then I want to touch on the other band members in a second as well, but on the album, you talk about making things new, and for sure, you definitely do that on tunes such as Oye Como Va,
right?
And especially, you know, my favorite, The Girl from Ipanema,
right?
Which kind of takes it into a, you know, there's been a lot of, in television this year, there's been a lot of things that are sort of pushing the medium to new levels, and there was the new season of Twin Peaks, and you know, David Lynch, as you know, is somebody, is a person who was very into the abstract and the absurd, and definitely that the treatment of that tune is almost in that vein of totally absurd. and it's great because, you know, try playing that at a wedding, because a couple of weeks ago I was at a friend's wedding in Long Island City, and they played the original Girl from Ipanema, you know, before the wedding on the PA system. And, you know, it's funny because a couple of days later, I ended up getting this album, and I heard your version. I was like, wow, that's totally insane. So how did that evolve, of taking such an iconic tune and turning it upside its head like that?
Right. Yeah, well, just out of sheer fun, you know? I mean, you know, that song is really popular as a guitar, nylon string duet with vocals, as well as, you know, that bands have been playing for years. And basically what this album for me was, it was kind of like a coming out with a different type. Oh, are you still there? I think we cut off.
Hello? I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
It's no more video, but okay. So yeah, what happened with me was, for this album was really about this hybrid finger picking technique that I've been trying to develop, where I have a pick in my hand, my right hand, but I'm still finger picking with the other three fingers. So I'm doing both at the same time, regular picking and finger picking, and kind of mixing up rhythms that go on and off the beat, and playing over these changes. So this song, Girl from Ipanema, was such a standard, and it's such an inside song that I thought it would be fun. Yeah, let's mess with it. Let's play with a song that's really sweet and push it into a different place. You know, it starts off kind of sweet, and then it goes on this journey to another place. And that's, you know, that's the fun part for me. You know, and that's why I love playing with this band so much, is because we can really go anywhere musically. It's a lot of fun to just explore. And all the songs are exploring. So, yeah, Girl from Ipanema, I remember rehearsing the song. Like, all the songs are recorded pretty much in one take, but we did have a rehearsal before, but what are we going to do on this record? And I remember saying, yeah, let's do Girl from Ipanema. And people like, really? And I was like, yeah, let's just do it. We'll take it out. It'll be fun. And then, you know, sure enough, everyone's like, yeah, okay, I see what you mean. It's a blast playing it from a more of a fusion perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly the second most unique interpretation of the piece that I've heard, because the other really unique version of that piece that I heard was Pat Metheny's version that he did 6 or 7 years ago in What It's All About. And he twisted it into the most dark thing you've ever heard in your life.
Oh, yeah. I wish I would have heard that. I didn't even know he did it.
Oh, yeah. He did it on baritone guitar.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love all Pat Metheny's work. You know, when he busts out those other instruments, you know, it's always fun to hear a different set of colors that he plays, you know. Because he does it always so beautifully.
Right. Now, you mentioned the hybrid picking. Mm-hmm. That's just one of the many processes that you use that fit into a whole continuum in terms of improvisers, in terms of individual approaches. For example, Ornette Coleman, harmonics.
Mm-hmm.
Wadada Leo Smith, he has something called anchromation, I believe. and Adam Rudolph, the percussionist, has a system that he calls cyclic verticalism. So, what I had mentioned before in our pre-interview, before this podcast, was that when you play a line, what I notice is that, similar to the harmonic concept with Ornette Coleman, Steve Rust and Peter O'Brien, they follow you, and what you play almost dictates what the harmony is, because Steve will follow exactly what you're playing, as will Peter O'Brien, and you guys have a very unique hookup. So just talk a little bit about how you first came to play with both Steve Rust and Peter O'Brien, and how your concept developed.
Yeah, well, back in 2015, my wife and I had a little art gallery that we rented out for 8 months. She's an artist, and I also do nature photography, and I was playing music there. So, long story short, Miles Griffith called me up, not knowing that it was my place upstate, because we met in New York City in Queens. He's like, hey, man, I want a gig at your place. And I was like, who is this? He goes, this is Miles. I was like, Miles, remember me? He goes, oh, yeah, man, what's up? I was like, I'm not going to give you a gig with your band, but you can play with me in my band because I love what you do. And I wasn't really hiring other bands at the time. So anyway, he came up and played. I did a gig with him with some other guys. And then I hooked up with Pete O'Brien. And then I said, well, who do you like to play with? And he said, Steve Rust. And it just clicked. It was just a great vibe because, you know, everyone in there has a free approach. Like, everyone can play straight, but people want to go in a different direction and push the tunes. You know, and the thing is really is when Steve plays, you know, he'll play just very open. So wherever you go, he can follow. And that's why I love this band so much, because they'll, you know, they'll follow me, but they also push me. You know, especially like something that stuck out in my head. Listen to Doxy on the album. You know, Steve is doing some heavy grooving up and down the neck, and Pete's going with it and adding to it. And then I'm, you know, going either with it or against it or somewhere in between. You know, and I you know, when I'm improvising, it's really a trio, right? Because there's no vocals at that point. So we're kind of just going. I mean, we all have an internal sense of time. We all have our own time, but we push, you know, and play within the structure of the tune and the time as much as possible. So it's this constant interaction, constant weaving, constant push and pull that gives us the sound that we create for these particular albums.
Right. It's inner dialogue within the structures. While you're adhering to the structures, you're also going outside the structures.
Sure. I mean, rhythmically, like, you know, anything can sound okay and it'll be in tune. I mean, I generally play pretty out and Steve will follow me. So I'm always hitting the chord change on the next chord. At least I'm trying to, I should say. you know, hitting the chord change. But within that bar, you know, anything goes, you know, rhythmically, harmonically.
Yeah, and what's so fascinating about that too is, with that approach, this quartet that you have is really one of the, I feel, you know, since I got hipped up to it last year, it's really one of the best kept secrets in jazz that nobody knows about. And when you think about people who have defining bands, like for example, Dave Liebman has a group now, which is like one of his most defining bands of his career. I mean, this band is like that. I think for me, when I will think about your music 10, 15 years down the line, you know, I'm going to be thinking, yeah, this is the band that defined Brian Kasten's career. So, I mean, the concept is so individual, and you've talked to me before about you're in this as a lifer. And you're just playing wherever you feel the tune should go. And I think that's so important because you consider yourself an improviser in the truest sense.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for example, people ask me, sometimes people ask me, like, what do you do? I say, I play music. And then they say, you know, what do you play? I say, mostly improvised music. And they say, jazz. I'm like, yeah, jazz, because they know what I mean by that. But really, I don't really play traditional jazz. I don't even know what the definition of jazz is. I just know that I improvise and make up notes over chord changes, or no chord changes at times. You know? Yeah, so it's just anything goes, any point in time. We're always looking to move on to the next thing, the next vibe. And thank you for appreciating the band and what we do. You know, I know that you've always been supporting my last 2 albums, and thank you so much for understanding what we do and supporting it. So thank you. Appreciate it so much.
Yeah, and you had mentioned also that, you know, you started out listening to greats like Wes Montgomery and Kenny Burrell and guys like that, but it was really John Scofield who really influenced your conception at first, right?
Yeah. All those great guys, those straight ahead guys, I love them. And then once I started, see, I grew up in the 80s, right? So I grew up on metal too. So then when I heard Sco improvising with that dirtier sound, you know, like distortion and chorus in there, it kind of blew my mind. And also rhythmically, he was so out. You know, Sco is one of my biggest influences because he does so much and he's so loose. A few years back, I remember listening to Scofield and thinking, you know, why do I love him so much? Of course, it just feels right. But I started just really, you know, it just feels great. And I started listening to his rhythms. And I was like, you know, if you listen to his lines, his rhythmic structures and phrases are constantly starting and stopping at different points of the measure. So when I listen to him, my ear is always like, when's he going to start again? Because he's choosing different parts to start and stop. Mm-hmm. And that really helped my playing a lot because I didn't cop his rhythms, but I'm copying the concept of his phrasing, the idea of phrasing and stopping and starting. Whether it was from Wes, you know, Kenny Burrell, Charlie Christian, George Benson, you know, all those great cats up to Scofield. And then I would listen to, you know, I grew up on metal, you know.
Yeah.
I love this rock. I love the guitar player, George Lynch from Dokken. You know, I liked Metallica and Maiden and Priest. And so, you know, here I am 2017, you know, I love to improvise as a jazz player, but I love that rock tone. I only have it on a few songs on the album. You know, some of it is for three of the songs. The rest of it's kind of clean tone. But I like cranking up, and I like that feeling of just being able to make my guitar scream, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, this album is a culmination of a rock vibe, a jazz vibe, a loose vibe, and just having a good time.
Yeah, and it's so interesting you bring up metal because metal and jazz, there's definite connections as far as the virtuosity. I mean, sometimes the tightness. In your mind, what are the things that connect both of those genres together?
Well, I think you kind of nailed it, the virtuosity. I mean, a lot of those heavy metal guys have a lot of chops, and jazz guys too. But, you know, they have a lot of technique. But the difference between the jazz and the metal a lot of times is the jazz guys are improvising it. But from a sound, a lot of the metal guys, some of them can, but a lot of them play, you know, they might play a similar thing every night, but the jazz guy's goal is to play something new. But I just like the sound of making the guitar scream, you know. I'm a big Stevie Ray Vaughan fan, too. You know, he's got such a great blues sound. So, just the mixture of the technique and the vibe and the sound of making it scream, like, you know, I was listening to Steve Vai the other day, and he has such a cool way of having long notes.
Mm-hmm.
Then I listen to jazz, and I'm like, well, I like the rhythms that the modern jazz guys are playing, so let's kind of combine it. You know, one of my other favorite players is Wayne Krantz.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne Krantz is, you know, he's phenomenal. His own sense of rhythm and rhythmic vocabulary. So, you know, he'll crank up and wail, and then he'll so I kind of like falling in between having a sense of tradition and a sense of modern music as well.
Yeah, and Wayne Krantz is in the whole John Zorn orbit too, right? So
yeah, well, he's at his, that whole funky, free, kind of loose thing. He does it within his compositions. You know, I've watched several videos on YouTube of him playing and how he pushes the beat, plays over the bar line and things like that, or with the downbeat, which is interesting. So my playing and his playing for Not So Standard is really a mixture of, you know, yeah, come from the straight ahead, come from the fusion, come from the rock, come from the blues, come from the funk, and come from whatever, some classical finger picking that developed into a hybrid. It's kind of like a smorgasbord of ideas, you know.
Yeah, and you had mentioned too, that your music, in terms of the reception, there have been some challenges. And there are people who kind of try to classify it this way, oh, it's jazz, this way, it's jazz rock fusion, this way, it's free. But it's not really either of those. It's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thanks for recognizing that. You know, the thing is for me, at the end of the day, I just don't care. As far as, like, if people want to like it, like, of course I wanted them. My thought process is like this. I'm going to put out music that I feel and love at that time I'm recording it. If people love it, great. Like, you're totally into it. It's great. We could talk about it. And you know, and it's a lot of, it's interesting and fun to do. If people don't like it, I'm still going to put out more records, you know? It's not popular music. I mean, the way I look at it is like this. As far as some statistics I read, 1.1% of all records sold are jazz records, you know, and that's including smooth jazz, straight ahead jazz. So the stuff that I listen to is probably less than like 0.4% or something. So it is what it is, you know. It's kind of out there. It's sometimes avant-garde within the changes, you know, not just not so standard, but other albums. So, you know, I'm an artist who just wants to create because that's what I really have to do, you know, for myself. Yes. So I'm just going to keep plugging along. And, you know, do I want people along the way to dig it? Sure, because it would be great. But, you know, either way, I'm just going to keep cranking them out, you know?
Yeah, and also what's fascinating about the record, too, with Miles Griffith, he's really the closest link to the quote-unquote jazz tradition. But the way he approaches it, like on Beautiful Love, I mean, when he sings the lyrics, I mean, that's the closest thing to jazz, but when he starts improvising and the rhythm section just follows him and they tumble wherever he goes,
right,
I mean, that's great, because his experience and his palette is so wide. I mean, this is a man who got a Grammy with Wynton Marsalis,
and please go ahead.
Right, he's at the top level of the New York City jazz scene, and you know, the way you guys mesh is so great.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you know, because we're open to each other, like, we've always been cool. It's always been like, you know, I think a lot of times the reason why the music comes out where it meshes is because the vibe is cool, you know. Everyone in the band is just, they're all great people, they all want to just create something good and put out a good vibe. You know, and, you know, the great thing about Miles is, he'll sing Beautiful Love, gorgeous and sweet, and then he'll do his crazy out thing. But the thing about Miles that's unique is, you know, we've had several conversations about technique, and, you know, because he uses that rough, low part of his voice, you know, several people have suggested to him, you know, oh, you know, this is not his exact words, but people think that sometimes he's just screaming or messing with his voice in an unhealthy way. He's developed a technique that his voice is 100% healthy, and he sings in a way where it doesn't hurt his vocal cords or anything. So, you know, he has the ability to sing totally inside and pretty and beautiful standard, and then to play that rough stuff, which is out. You know, which is cool, because, you know, when you listen, you know, a funny thing that happened through our process is when we did gigs together, because we weren't playing in the greatest sound environment, sometimes I didn't hear everything he was doing, these little things with his voice. And then we went to the studio and it was crystal clear. I was like, oh, man, you know, I hear so much more, you know, and that makes us more in the studio, you know, kind of click even more together. So Miles, but, you know, by the flip of a switch, can go nutsoid or he can sing inside. And so we kind of just want to meet up together and find some unity in that moment, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the guy is really a walking instrument. He's a walking horn, you know. And that's what I love, jazz vocalists who are like walking horns, like Ella or Sarah Vaughan or you know, John Hendricks, people like that who were, you know, they really use their instrument to the fullest extent. And the other thing about this music, too, that's so great and appealing is that it's fun. You know, so much jazz fans and jazz musicians sometimes take the music way too seriously.
Yeah, we just want to have a good time and be loose. You know, sometimes on the free gigs, when we're not playing any tunes, like on Roll the Dice on Life, I didn't do it on the album, but sometimes when we're playing live, I'll just start off the song and off screen for fun. And people look at you like, what are you doing? And then they see, oh, it's, you know, we're just kind of bugging out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, if I'm not having a good time, what's the point? You know? So, yeah, the music is loose. I mean, a lot of my music is based off of, you know, I have a groove or Miles will sing a melody. And then when we start improvising on top of it, it's just about having a good time and being in the moment and pushing it wherever we can, as far as we can push it for that particular point, you know, in time.
Right, right. Now, you're also an award-winning photographer. So how does your concept of photography tie into the music?
Yeah, well, it's all, in a way, somewhat similar. It's all color. So my focus is pretty much nature photography. You know, I've been going out now and going to, like, dry riverbeds where the fall leaves are red and there's rocks coming out of the riverbed. And there's maybe some water coming through. And I'm taking photos and I'm capturing the water, which is the way I take the photos. I kind of turn it into smoke, which becomes white. You have the red and green and yellow of the leaves and the brown. You have also the green of the moss on the rocks. But how that ties into the music is when I hear music, I see color in my head. You know, like to me, Pat Metheny, who I love, is white in my brain. Don't know why. You know, Scofield is like a blue and white mix. You know, somebody like Kranz is like kind of more orangey to me. So when I'm playing or taking photos or listening, I just hear color. That's how my brain processes it. So ultimately what I want to do is, my newer albums are going to be music and photography, nature photography together. So if I put out an album, I might have like 20, 30, 40 photos in it where people can buy the book of it too to see the more of the correlation between the music and the imagery. You know? And write the music along with the imagery.
Yeah, yeah. Because it gives people it gives them something to focus on, but also at the same time, they can also obviously create their own images, you know, to the music as well. You mentioned the color. That's so interesting. What color would another one of your prime influences be? David Fuzinski. What color would his?
That's a good, you know, I was just listening to him the other day. He's kind of more like, to me, he's kind of got more of like a brown to me. I don't know why, because he plays so out in a good way.
Yeah.
You know, and loose, like brown and also kind of like, kind of yellowy. Because he likes to scream, you know, he likes to like really bend the shit out of his strings. Ooh, can I say that? He likes to bend the strings. So I guess the brighter, sometimes the higher up, the brighter it gets, you know. And there's no rhyme or reason for the colors that I hear in my brain or see in my brain.
Well, it's interesting that you say white for Pat, because, you know, white is a color that, in terms of, like, when you think about spirituality, it's something that represents, like, the highest level, like, in terms of spirit. And also, you know, like, in some Asian cultures, white is also a sign of, like, evil. And you know how Pat's music sometimes goes between extremes of melodic and then, in the case of Zero Tolerance for Silence or Tap, completely out.
Yeah, so you know, I mean, to me, you know, Pat Metheny is such an uplifting, you know, even if he's playing something out, it's always uplifting to me. Like, the stuff he did with Scofield, I can see
Your House from Here. Yeah, it's a great album.
Yeah, it's a great album. You know, they do some out stuff. To me, you know, it's funny, if you listen to the album, the Pat Metheny album, that he, the duet album that he has, where it's him and the bass player, you know,
Charlie Hayden, Beyond the Missouri Sky.
Yeah, Beyond the Missouri Sky with Charlie Hayden. You know, he plays the nylon string for a lot of it, and it's so beautiful, it's so sensitive, it's so soft in a mellow way, where it's more like you for my ears, just want to sit within those notes that he's playing. He's not playing a lot of notes, so that's very white. But then when I listen to him play with Scofield, you know, that I Can See Your House From Here, to me it seems a little bit more gray. It's more edgy. He's got a totally different electric guitar and tone, and so totally different vibe. But either way, it's still within that that white grayish type of vibe for me.
Yeah. And you know, Pat is, you know, he's probably my favorite living guitar player. And I told you, it was a teacher of mine back in high school who really turned me on to him. And I, like, over the past 15 years, I've just devoured his stuff, like, nonstop.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's easy to do, right? Because he has so much stuff. He'll do a duet thing. I mean, I have a couple of his videos. You know, he'll start off with, like, a classical guitar sitting on the end of the stage.
Yeah.
He'll do a trio thing with, like, Antonio Sanchez, who tears it up, of course, you know? And then he'll go into, like, a bigger band thing and then do a more out vibe with more instruments and Lyle Mays, who I love. So, you know, he's got so many years of creating great music. It's, you know, it's easy to get to absorb what he does.
Yeah, and also, you know, his playing is starting to evolve in the evolution of tone. I don't know if you heard the album that Kung Vu did with him last year, the Kung Vu Trio meets Pat Metheny.
You know, I did hear a couple tracks of that on Spotify.
Yeah, Pat is really, like, he got the Roland GR300 guitar synthesizer 30 years ago, before I was born, you know? And he's now exploring colors with it that he's had it for all this time. They're new colors. Like, what he's doing on that album with Kung Vu, you've never heard him do anything like that, ever. And it's amazing. You know, he's been involved into looping now for several years, and that adds another level. And then, of course, the Orchestrion.
Right.
You know, that's, you know, he's unbelievable. And then there's other guitarists like that too, like David Fusinski, who just pushed the boundaries. And then, you know, Bill Frisell is another guy too.
Right.
That's absolutely. He's got a terrific album with Thomas Morgan that came out on ECM called Small Town.
I have it.
Yeah, it's beautiful, right?
Yeah, I like the sense of space. I love guitar and just upright bass.
It's also one of the most, in terms of recording quality, that album is one of the most, it's just one of the most amazing from the Village Vanguard.
Oh, that was live?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's unbelievable. Of course, ECM albums always sound incredible.
Right.
And your photos actually remind me a lot of ECM album cover shots.
Yeah, BrianCastingPhotography.com.
Yeah. You know, another thing that I would love to turn to in this interview before we start wrapping things up is you were a music educator for some time in the New York Jazz Workshop. That's a jazz school in Midtown Manhattan. And they focus on all sorts of disciplines, you know, vocals, they have composition, they have improvisation. They have a world-class faculty, including, they have Kenny Wessel, Miles Okazaki, and Vic Juris all on their faculty.
Right.
You know, in terms of your history of being an educator, what is your take on the way jazz is represented in the education system?
Well, I think it's pretty poor, actually. You know, I taught at high school in Queens, and most kids don't even know who Louis Armstrong is. And Louis Armstrong's museum is in Corona. That was before I taught high school. I taught at the Louis Armstrong Elementary School. And when I was there, you know, they didn't even have a band program. They didn't even have a music. They didn't have a music program until I came. And, you know, it was. Honestly, it's kind of sad, man, because, you know, jazz originated here, you know, in the United States, and there needs to be more of a focus on educating young folks about jazz, about improvisation, about the American spirit through sound, right?
Yeah.
You know, there needs to be more of that, you know? You know, I mean, I can go on about it for a while of why, but, you know, it's really just where the culture is. I mean, it's 2017. I mean, jazz isn't promoted as much. I mean, people aren't making a lot of money at it. So the money pushes the industry. you know? And then the school systems want to play, they want the teachers to put on a performance that the parents want to hear. You know?
Yeah, right.
So if the parents aren't into jazz, then, you know, then the schools don't push for it. You know, so it's just kind of like negative cycle of like music industry, you know, what people like. And, you know, then it becomes the music teachers like myself are pushing for jazz and people are like, no, but I want this, you know, other song that's on the radio so to make some parent happy. So that's kind of really goes on.
Right. And we talk about your new album obviously being standards. Do you feel that the emphasis on standards and sort of occasionally older jazz musicians maybe being so tied to a particular tradition, do you feel like that maybe sometimes turns off potential new listeners to the music?
Oh, absolutely it does. I mean, some people come from the mindset of being traditional as far as the musical approach and as far as the sound, and that's cool because I love the music that they love. You know, I love... You know, Wes, I love George Benson, I love Kenny Burrell, I love Carly Christian, I love Miles Coltrane, even though Coltrane was kind of, you know, they went out, he went out, but I love all that music too. And if people, you know, I just embrace people for what they want to be into. If they're into that stuff, that's cool. And as far as my music, if they're not into it because they think it's too much of a fusion thing, well, that's cool. You know, I'm just going to do what I do because I feel that I need to say what I need to say now.
Yeah.
And no, there's no restrictions. I mean, I don't have a record label. Every note that I played for all 10 of my albums was exactly the one at the time. Now, looking back, would I do things differently and play, make better choices? Yeah, sure. I don't know if he's, you know, an analytical musician who wouldn't. But at the time I played it, that's what I wanted, unsolicited, you know, of just pure, that's what I'm doing. I'm putting everything out myself. And the art's as pure as it can be for that point in time.
Yeah, and talking about the tradition, tell me that story again about Jimmy Heath. You got a chance to hang out with the great Jimmy Heath.
Yeah. Well, when I was teaching at the Louis Armstrong School in Queens on 111th Street, I believe, I walked over there in the morning just to check out this, his house, and a guy who was running comes out. He's like, can I help you? I said, oh, you know, I'm the music teacher at the school. He's like, well, why don't you come by tonight and hang out? Some people will be there. So I was like, all right, great. So I go over there, and Jimmy Heath's there. Now, I'm hanging out with Jimmy Heath in Louis Armstrong's basement. This was like about 11 years ago, 10, 11 years ago. And I spoke to Jimmy Heath for like an hour. And that was like, you know, that's like jazz history right there. I think Jimmy was like, he was 80 years old at the time. And he was just telling me this cool story. He's just like, Dizzy Gillespie lived in the house behind Louis's house. And that all these other cats were around at the time. We'd get together and play and talk about music. And, you know, this is the type of stuff that you won't get from a magazine or something or an interview of these, you know, Jimmy Heath or something. It was just very personable, very nice. He was great. He was mentally so on and smart at 80 years old. It was amazing, you know.
I mean, he's really one of the true standard bearers of this music. I mean, he's like, his playing is just incredible. And then, of course, the compositions he's contributed to the canon.
Yeah. There's one thing that sticks out my mind. I think you'll appreciate. He says to me, you know, I was in my like early, I was like in my early 30s at the time, you know, and so. You know, I'm always trying to work a gig, you know. So I was like, hey, man, I had this beat-up demo that I recorded. I was like, maybe we'll get together and play. And, you know, so I gave him a CD, and he goes, you know, man, he goes, when you're in your 40s, a lot of times people find their voice. He goes, wait till you're in your 40s, and you'll find your voice. And it resonated in me. And it must have hit me deep in my subconscious because I feel now that I'm in my 40s, I feel like, yeah, I totally understand what you're talking about because I have this time from, you know, 30s to 40s to develop more into who I am. And it was great to have such a jazz master like Jimmy Heath, you know, just being cool and laid back and talking to me for an hour and saying stuff like that because you know, he is jazz master.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, actually, that puts me in mind. I was watching an interview the other day. Do you remember the organist Ronnie Foster?
I'm not familiar.
Well, he was George Benson's musical director from Breezin on.
Oh, okay, yeah, right.
And he
plays
keyboards on those records.
Right.
So, you know, And Ronnie Foster's another guy who I'd love to get for this podcast. But he was talking about how when he was 12 years old, because Ronnie's been sort of having a resurgence with his trio. He was talking about when he was 12 years old, he was taught by Jimmy Smith. And when he was 15 years old, he met George Benson. And, you know, he started working with Benson when he was, like, that young.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he joined Grant Green's group. And he joined Grant Green because he was originally going to join Stanley Turrentine. But for some reason, the gig didn't work out. So Grant Green showed up up at his doorstep and said, you know, I want you to take this gig.
Right.
And from then on, you know, Ronnie was signed to Blue Note Records. And then it skyrocketed from there. So you're talking about Jimmy Heath and the history. That just kind of reminded me of that, you know, listening to Ronnie Foster talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's great through time. You know, I think a cat like Jimmy Heath, you know, because he loves the music and loves the art so much, I think he wants to give as much as he can give and pass it on to younger players. You know, it was just a conversation with him for an hour, but I think he wanted to instill like ideas in my head of like good things and about playing and about music, you know. And he actually said to me, I remember, he goes, you know, we got to get these kids going. So I told him, I said, I'm a teacher at the school a few blocks away. He's like, oh, we got to get these kids going. We got to get them some instruments and do things. And he was really into like getting them into music, you know, and into jazz.
Yeah.
You know,
it's important.
So. Yeah.
Obviously, Wynton Marsalis and Lincoln Center, Jazz at Lincoln Center, that's the biggest, you know, program for getting people into jazz. I mean, you know, personally, I think I definitely have, you know, my own views on what, you know, how Wynton approaches music from,
right.
You know, what his views are in terms of jazz and, you know, but, any sense of what you can do to bring jazz education is so important. And one of the things that I've always, you know, I've been doing this review thing seriously with my own blog for a couple of years now. And what I'm really noticing even more so than when I was just a fan buying records is that there is a tremendous gap in terms of the amount of white jazz musicians versus black jazz musicians who were young. And
do you mean that? What do you mean? Like, you mean the ratio percentage of white versus black?
Yeah, in terms of musicians, yeah, who are, you know, coming into jazz. I mean, there's obviously terrific, you know, young black musicians like Robert Glasper and Ben Williams. You know, Robert Glasper, Ben Williams, Derek Hodge, Ambrose Akinmusare. But like, you know, I wonder what could be done to bring more, like, young black people into jazz. Because it's certainly not as prevalent, you know, as it was back in, like, the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, well, I think it's you know, the same for any race. I think it's just about exposure.
Yeah.
You know, it's about exposure. You know, I used to do this thing when I was a high school teacher. I used to put on, Bill Frisell. I think it was called I'm Not a Farmer, something like that. Bill Frisell. I used to put on Miles Davis, Louis Armstrong. I used to put on Ravi Shankar, you know, the Indian sitar player.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of slew, Dizzy Gillespie, Thelonious Monk. And I would play it for kids. These are high school kids. I'd play it for them beginning of semester. And I was like, raise your hand if you like it. And like, out of 50 kids, maybe two or three kids might like it. And only because their parents listened to it, so it was already in their ear. And I was like, by the end of this semester, I guarantee you, there's going to be a lot more people who dig it. They're like, no, this music sucks, I don't like it, because they're more into whatever's current on the radio. I was like, you'll see. So I played it every day, just like when they would walk in, you know. And sometimes I would play it live. And by the end of the semester, I'm like, who likes this traditional jazz? And like 90% of the kids were like, I like it. And I said, yeah, why? And they said, well, because I'm more used to hearing it now. And I said, yeah, exactly. Your ears are attuned to it. So if you open your mind and your ears to it, then you're willing to accept it, you know? And so that's why I say exposure. it you know, regardless of race, it's just being exposed to these sounds, exposed to these rhythms in the music. And then you know, the culture can grow. You know, hey man, I believe in the American spirit, in the sense of, like, in this times of ridiculous Trumpism. You know, not to get all political, but just saying, like, it's become so narrow and so tight, the school system, about Common Core and money and nonsense, that hopefully we get past all this stuff and we get back to what it is, focus on being a better creative American, which is giving people jazz, giving people an outlet to express themselves, you know, and then things will come back, you know, and hopefully be even better, you know.
Yeah, and actually that's a nice extension on my podcast with Antonio Sanchez, because primarily, in addition to talking about Bad Hombre, we're talking about the political situation. And what you're saying about the schools and it being so tight, me being a person who has a physical disability,
right.
Seeing what Betsy DeVos is doing to try to eliminate things that would help people with disabilities thrive is just...
Yeah.
It's unbelievable, because my mom, for over 20 years, she was an advocate for the Johnson City School District in Johnson City, New York, which is where I grew up. That's in the Binghamton area.
Okay.
Which is about 4.5 hours upstate from here.
Right.
And, you know, she worked not only for making sure that I got the best education that I could, but also for other parents who had kids with disabilities to help them thrive. And just the fact that that's going on in the schools right now, trying to eliminate that.
Let me tell you, man. I've taught 50 kids a class, 300 a day at 5 classes. The school system is honestly, it's designed for failure for certain kids. Certain kids will just, because they have limitations coming in that can grow tremendously, the system doesn't allow for that. And that extends beyond music. You know,
right.
But the thing is, from a music perspective, is, you know, I've had conversations with principals and people who ran the school. I'm like, look, this kid is a brilliant musician. He might not do well academically, but he can do something in the music world. Give him a chance. I've had several conversations where I'm like, give me money to put a drum in this kid's hand, put a guitar in this kid's hand. Give this kid an outlet. He's not going to, you know, he doesn't want to do the formal education thing. Let him be a musician and do something great with his life. You know, and so, you know, getting back to children and exposure to things, you know, if you don't have a school system who's on board with that, unless they're coming up with the funds to buy their own instrument, it's really hard to get to move forward, you know. So anyway, I'm an advocate of, you know, doing everything that's right for these kids in every way possible. It's just getting back to the whole, I said, the ridiculous Trumpism idea. I mean, he's making it worse. So once we're past this ridiculous cycle, sociopathic moron, then we can move forward, right? And then get people who have a brain, who actually care about the children, who actually want them to learn something good. You know, and it's more than just, you know, the music. It's about what you're putting out as a person. Because if the kid is focused on focusing on saying something, he's going to say something worthy, he's going to say something worthwhile, whether it's through lyrics or just through sound, you know. And that's why Miles, to me, is so potent, because he's not just saying the lyrics, his words, his notes, his sounds have expressions that are in the changes, you know. So if you lay out this progressive way where kids can learn, then and it's, you know, that can go on for a while, but it's not like, it's not, you know, the jazz, the improvisation will extend through cultures. You know, white kids would be cool with black kids cool with white kids, Asian kids, you know, Hispanic kids, you know, because they're all searching for the same thing, which is to hook up, to play music, to have a good vibe, and just, you know, enjoy life.
Yeah, and that kind of unity hooks up. That kind of unity is found in, like, urban inner city centers too, especially where kids all grow up together.
Yeah.
And there's no division between, okay, because you're Puerto Rican or because you're Mexican or because you're Asian. It's like, it's great, because that's what needs to be
implement.
You need to have more of that.
Yeah. I agree 100%. I mean, when I was teaching, it was about 40% black, 40% Hispanic, and, you know, there was like 6 white kids in the school, so the rest were all Asian, about 9.5% Asian, whatever it is. You know, so it was cool to see when you get kids together working on tuned and working, doing things together. I mean, a lot of kids these days, they're just into want to have fun and play some tunes. So when you get them together, it gets them to communicate, how are we going to work on the song, how are we going to develop the sound of our band, and it just makes the relationship better, you know. And music brings people together. That's what's cool about it.
Absolutely. And actually, I'm just thinking of something totally random. You know that recent Geico commercial with the guy in the orchestra playing the triangle, and all of a sudden he just takes his triangle solo and he's doing like ridiculous stuff, like rolling all over the floor.
I didn't see it.
And during the duck walk, like, that just reminded me of that, because it's like, you know, you're giving kids a chance to like really come forward and step forward on their instruments, and, you know, so actually that kind of reminded me of that commercial. But, you know, if people want to check out your music, they can go to briankasten.com, right?
Yes, briankasten.com. Check me out. I'm always posting new gigs. You can click on the CD Baby link here, a bunch of albums.
For the New York Jazz Workshop podcast, I'm CJ Shern. Peace, love, groove, and keep swinging, everybody.